Thank you for being here. Thank you for being here instead of being at Windows 10 Enterprise Mobility, Universal Windows Platform Decoded, the ecstasy of deployment, tomorrow's world of web development. In light of, you know, what is the technical day, I thank you for choosing a very non-technical talk. So, and my slides are already up on the internet, so feel free to have a look at that and snooze your way through this before you hear the powerful Brian Cox after this. I'm going to talk a little bit about some hard problems in IoT, frankly, and some things that I think we don't talk about enough. And I would really like to actually spend quite a lot of time in Q&A with you all for us to have a discussion about why those things are not happening, because it would suck for me to just stand here, talk at you, and then you leave and I see the results on Twitter. So that would be terrible. So I will make this as short as I can, and then we'll have a little bit of a chat. Is that okay with everybody? Happy? Vaguely happy. Cool. Awesome. All right. Oh, there's a clicker. Awesome. So a little bit about myself for those of you who I haven't met yet. I am a product designer, interaction designer. My first business, we were the first UK distributor of the Arduino board. Who here owns an Arduino? Keep your hand up if you've made something with it. Ooh, that's not bad. That's really good. I want to know what you made, actually. Usually people put their hand down afterwards. So who has heard of the Raspberry Pi? Right. So the Arduino is pre-Raspberry Pi, open source hardware, open source software, made in Italy, now made all over the world, and really the precursor to the Raspberry Pi. Much cheaper, different programming language, very accessible. So you should check it out if you're interested in the Raspberry Pi and all things Raspberry Pi. I then kind of moved on to being part of a very small design partnership and then formed my own consultancy, writing or managing a business around IoT in 2007 to 2010 was very difficult. And so being a consultant is a lot less difficult. I also have a connected product, which I'll talk about, called the Goodnight Lamp. And even if I came up with the idea 10 years ago, it turns out that these things are still quite difficult. And this is also part of what we'll talk about, hopefully. And I also run the London Internet of Things meetup, which is the biggest meetup in the world around this topic right now. Please come by and hang out. It's once a month. It's very friendly. It's free. It's massively oversubscribed, but you can usually just show up. But don't tweet that, because everybody might show up. And so what that makes me is kind of this weird traditional product designer, industrial designer. I'd studied industrial design. And I've worked in really the intersection of industrial design, product design, and digital experiences, kind of connecting these two worlds. And for an industrial designer, for someone with my background, that's actually quite rare. I meet a lot more technologists and people who come from the digital world and from the world of code who are interested in building physical experiences than I meet product designers interested in the web in that way. They're interested in using the web as e-commerce platforms, but that's not really IoT. You know, I'm always interested in meeting other people with this kind of thinking, but who knows? And what I've noticed, at least in the past 10 years, is really fundamentally from the standpoint of products, we've sort of run out of ideas. A lot of the inspiration for what the future stood for was really created in the 50s, in an era where a lot of engineers were out of work because the war was over, and so they had to, you know, find work in large corporations, and in those large corporations try to reintegrate that wartime technology so that we could see the future in a super exciting, you know, way, because suddenly we didn't have to necessarily be at war all the time. And most of those ideas, bar the personal helicopter, which I really like, and the idea of a personal helipad, which is very funny. Most of these ideas we've attempted in some way, shape, or form. And they're either in progress or we're sort of working around them or discovering they weren't such good ideas in the first place. But really, we've run out of steam in that particular era of ideas and era of visual ideas. And, you know, don't they look beautiful? Doesn't this future look awesome? My kitchen, I wish my kitchen looked like that. Jetpacks, where is my jetpack? So I think that that time has really, in a way, or needs to come to an end. I think we hold on to that time as technologists in a way that's slightly unhelpful. And again, I'd love your feedback on whether that's true or not. This is just, you know, me on a stage. And I think we kind of need new ideas. So if the Internet of Things is supposed to help us mix two industries who formerly would have worked in complete isolation, surely it should be for the betterment of a world that we now exist in and to solve some hard problems that we have and to make the future happen, and a future that we believe in, that we think is sustainable, that we think is interesting. Oh my God, I said the word sustainable. No, this is not going to be one of those talks, but kind of. So we want objects around us, and we want connectivity around us, but we also want to get somewhere with all of this. I read on the train over here that we've downgraded from 50 billion devices to 20 billion devices today. Thank you to Gartner. So you know, beyond the kind of abstract ideals around things being connected, what are those things, and what are they going to allow us to do? And what kind of world will they build for us? And ultimately, you know, in business speak, what does success look like for any particular idea? And I think for our industry, success looks like a number of different things. And in a way, this talk is what I would like to see happen. It might not be what you or your organization would like to see happen, but I think this hopefully touches on some things that everybody would like to see happen. One of which is to perhaps move towards a more active society. And when I mean active, I don't mean getting up and jogging. I mean active in terms of engaged. If you look at smart city and the smart city discourse, anybody here work in vaguely smart city stuff-ish? No one-ish? So when we talk about smart city ideas, we talk often about people being engaged and citizens being engaged. That's actually really difficult now because it's much easier to click on an e-petition than it is to make a decision about how you're going to move about the city in a different way, about showing up at your council meetings and real engagement. So how do we do that with IoT and physical objects? We do that in potentially a number of different ways. So the air quality egg, which is now quite an old idea, is an air quality sensor that you have at home and that you hang outside the window, and it looks at the pollution level around you and maps that onto a map. And if you have enough of these, you start to have a really granular map of what air pollution in your area looks like. Not something that necessarily in the Western world we're so concerned about right now, because it's sort of an invisible problem. We sort of ignore the fact that we're 20 times over the EU limit on pollution in most major cities. But in places like Shanghai, for example, and Beijing, they are now starting to look at the indoor quality of the air inside schools for parents to make a decision about whether they want their child to go to that school or not. And so these are problems that are really emerging in parts of the world. We're sort of, we're conveniently ignoring them for now, and we have that kind of government right now to conveniently ignore these kinds of things. But these are solutions out there that exist that just need a little bit of help and point to a future where we are active in deciding to give information out about our environment and where we live. This project is kind of an interesting one from an organizational standpoint because it was completely organized online. So it was completely organized on Google Groups. It was a group of people who came together organically, some architects from New York, some hardware developers from Spain, and they built the project from scratch. And it's now, you know, on sale. This is a product you can now buy. It's extremely expensive because they don't have the massive marketing budgets, but it's there. You can buy it. You can, you know, map out your data. All it would need is a little bit of help. Another example of activism in their in a more profound sense even is the Japan Geiger maps. Who has seen this project before? Might be a few. So this is a project where a bunch of technologists in Japan, post-Fukushima, decided that they were going to open up the way in which a Geiger counter might post its data to the web. So they made a little tutorial. You could buy an off-the-shelf Geiger counter, and you could then connect that data up to the web. My friend Hyann, who now works at Microsoft, built the online map for it. And all that data suddenly started being populated because, of course, people were extremely worried about the level of radiation around their city, whether the radiation was moving towards Tokyo or not. And immediately it was clear that the radiation was far exceeding what the government was ready to admit. And for a long time, the government was like, no, we're fine, everything's fine. And this was such an important piece of communication that it forced the government to disclose their data in a PDF, but it was better than nothing. And eventually, this became a recurring piece of publication that they were really essentially forced to produce. Because all that had happened before were men in clipboards that showed up at Fukushima, wrote some things down, and left. So this is real activism with hardware, with software, with mapping, with data, with all the things we talk about, but things that actually make change in the world. And surely we're in technology because we want to change the world, I think. This is another project which is fantastic, which is called the Oxford Flood Network. This is a guy called Ben Ward who lives in Oxford, and there were some floodings a few years ago. During Christmas time, it was horrible. A lot of people lost a lot of property. Some of them still don't have those houses in, you know, the same state, and it cost people a lot of money. So what he decided to do was build a very simple distance sensor that he would stick underneath bridges, and it just measured the level of water. Very simple tech, very simple from a sort of battery life cycle perspective, and he is now working with Nominet, who are the domain registrar in the UK, and they're helping him build the entire software layer of this and the mapping data. Because, of course, what you can then do, again as a citizen, is you can decide to subscribe to your local sensors. You want to see, you know, what's going to happen to your house. The whole information is, you know, important as well. But whether the bridge next to your house is seeing flooding happen is the piece of information that matters to you. And he is still working with a very small team, very, very organic growth, as it were, no real investment. But these are ideas that need some help again. So we kind of talked about activism, and I think that there's also a really great place for IoT, which is the place where it opens up possibilities in systems that close possibilities right now. And that's kind of a funny thing to say at an event sponsored by Microsoft or run by Microsoft, but I think that Microsoft is also more agile and more exciting than a lot of very, very big institutions. And when I mean big institution, I kind of mean the NHS and places like that, the National Health Service, if you're not from the UK. And in the world of 3D printing, for example, there's a lot that's being done now that's extremely exciting. So prosthetics and 3D printed prosthetics have become an extremely exciting space. Whether they see the type of investment that they should in order to really become ubiquitous so that every single hospital or every single GP starts to have a 3D printer so that they can cater to an amputee or a small child, anything, you know, anyone who might have a need for a prosthetic, distribution and access is going to be key. But the companies are out there now, and they're very young. So Andiamo, for example, is based in East London, and what they do is they go to a home, They 3D scan a child that has a physical disability, and they produce a brace that's 3D printed. And that brace is then made within a couple of days. The child doesn't have time to grow that much. And the brace is produced, sent to the house and the family, and then a few months later, or weeks later, when the child it has outgrown it, they just print another one. This makes total sense. And the founders of Andiamo are parents who themselves had a child with a disability, and they, on the NHS, had to wait 12 to 13 weeks for braces to be made, which is ridiculous, because the tech exists, but the funding isn't there, the access isn't there, the distribution isn't there. All things that are easily solvable. These are not hard problems. They're not really hard problems. And then, of course, there's kind of building technological gaps. Bless you. There's building technological gaps between generations. So my parents are on the kind of geeky-ish side. My dad is trying to build drones at the minute, which is fantastic because he used to build little airplanes when he was, kind of 10 years ago. But it doesn't mean that they have any clue as to how I use tech, how I engage with tech, what my availability is. So I built the Goodnight Lamp, and the Goodnight Lamp is a family of lamps. You have a big lamp and a little lamp, so you give the little lamps away to anybody around the world. When you turn the big lamp on, the little ones turn on. So as a way of saying, now's a good time, I'm available right now, this is good. Or reversely, my father's been very ill, for them to tell me, you should call now, it's important. And I kind of want to know. I want to know on a very simple level that's accessible. And I want to know even in the depths of Canada where they live. And products like this are kind of weird and kind of niche and kind of quirky. Not in the corporate way. And they still, there is still a space for niche products because we are surrounded by niche products. Every one of you will have a product that doesn't necessarily sell millions of something. It'll be a piece of garment. It might be your choice of toothbrush. It'll be something very small that does something for you. And I think thinking about scale in the sense of all kinds of scales is something we don't often do with IoT. We think of scale as billions of devices. Actually, thousands might also be pretty good. And really, again, kind of a hard problem that no one likes to think about is really living with climate change. This is something that we, have tried to ignore for a very long time. These are things we don't like to think about, but these are things that kind of exist. There's a huge landscape, of course, of how to deal with the effects of climate change, and certainly the air quality egg and the Oxford Flood Network point to that. But, this is kind of a free idea around stuff that also could be built, which is, again, monitors and monitoring devices around things that already exist that start to add a bit more information and a bit more information to make me make better decisions as a citizen. I have rhinitis, which means I am constantly allergic to everything under the sun. I'm like that woman that has Kleenex in her bags all the time. This is me. And if someone told me, don't walk down the high street and don't walk down that street because all the white vans go down that street, I wouldn't. I would avoid it. I would spend a little bit more time, which is fine because it'll be great for health and, we all need to be walking more, etc. And the other, of course, big, huge area around IoT is agriculture. And if you were here two sessions ago, another speaker spoke about this. And I'm sure he's covered this already, but I thought I'd point you to a very interesting startup in that space, which bridges the gap between, the consumer and the farm. So Jemaya, of course, cleverly cut off by the slide, are a startup who basically do image analysis. So you send a Cessna out or a drone out or whatever it is. It looks at the land that a farmer might have. But not only do they do that and do the analysis and the data and the mapping and the decision support, but they also allow the farmers through a very, very simple app to say, this is where that food came from. This is how it was grown. And more importantly, these are the people, this is how many people were hired during this process and how long they worked on this. So there's suddenly kind of information that's revealed that might make me buy things in completely different ways, because we suddenly start to think about the carbon footprint of the food that we have in a more granular way than this came from Spain. This came from Spain, and then what? How did it get here? Why is it tasteless? Oh, it came in a boat and freezers. Maybe I should buy some from Somerset instead. There's a huge amount of information that the farming industry has access to that we don't see as consumers. And we are going to have to change the way we eat. And they are changing the way they farm. So in between the two, there is a really great opportunity for communication and new tools and really utilizing both hardware and software, whether it's sensors in the soil, whether it's taking pictures from a drone, whatever you want to do. There's opportunities there that are huge and a market that is huge. But I went to the AgriTech Investment Summit last week, and everybody's complaining about the lack of investment. And everybody's complaining about how they can't find any money. And this is a huge deal. This is a huge industry. This is an industry very, very, very fragmented, but still huge. And so this is sort of, you know, all the things that we want to be doing. We know we want this as a society, but we don't necessarily support the businesses that end up providing us with potential solutions. And I'm kind of interested in also why we keep treating people like they're idiots somehow. So when I buy a connected device, a commercial connected device, I have no idea what's done with my data. I have no idea about who owns that and where it sits and, you know, how often data is being pulled or anything like that. And really, and this is, again, an idea I'd like to kind of talk about, is whether we don't end up with, you know, smarter product labeling that actually discloses all these things to people. I want to know what kind of technology is involved in my wearable device. As a consumer, as a grandma somewhere that's been giving this for Christmas, we're about to give our grandmas and our uncles and our nieces a whole bunch of tech in about a month and a half. And who owns this, the data associated with these things, where does it sit? Is there a URL I can go to, because I'd like to delete that data because I want to give it to a niece or a nephew, you know, where I want to sell it on eBay, and I want whatever is associated with that product to disappear. We don't inform people. We leave them in the dark. We sell them stuff, and they sometimes have no interest in really using for the long term, but we don't give them the mechanism to own the whole loop around where that product sits, that product, our data that we produce with it, and the experience globally. And I think that's something that we need to really address again. And there are really, you know, fundamental things and fundamental issues that we have as societies that, again, we don't like to either support or think about very much. So this is not necessarily a particularly good example, but I think it's one of many, of security device, personal safety devices. This one in particular, you tapped three times if you thought that you were in danger, and it would start an audio feed. And it would start recording what was around you and would call a security company. And if you had made, you know, you were kind of worried for no reason, you'd open up your mobile phone and just cancel the call and it would be fine. But it's a very, very simple mechanism when so many women and so many also men suffer from, you know, random acts of unkindness in the public space. And we don't give people tools. We sort of exist in a world of thinking about technology in the abstract and not looking at it when it's applied. All of this world ends up as little boxes in a graph that says applications. And I think we need to stop that, and we need to really think about what we'd like to build and really try to build it. Unfortunately, Artemis is now stopped. They have stopped trying to find funding after about 2 years, and I'll talk about that a little bit. But that's a shame, because I think it's a good idea. And of course, the things that we really don't like to think about, which are about care and end of life. And these are things that are very, unfortunately, very close to my heart at the minute. But a lot of startups are in that space of elderly care. And again, you know, it's an area that most people don't like to think about, but I'm sure all of you have an elderly parent somewhere. Everybody has a parent that's getting older because we're getting older. And the tools available to that community, the technology tools available for the elderly, are ridiculous. You go to a tech fair for elderly care, and it is gray boxes from here to Nantucket. It is crazy. It's terrible design, terrible user experiences, expensive products, expensive subscription for absolutely no reason. And, you know, again, this needs to change. If we want to build the society that we think we want to build, which is one where everybody is happier, can live longer, more prosperous life. And this is one startup in London called Kamuri. They make a little plug that's a smart plug that just looks at the activities around the house. And if there's suddenly, very suddenly, no activity at all, then it might inform a loved one. Very, very simple application. Leonard, who's the founder, has been going for about 2.5 years or so. No funding, nowhere. No help. So this is future decoded. You're supposed to talk about the future. I think the future is the one that's right in front of us and not necessarily the one that's 10 years away, because the one that's in front of us actually is the one that's harder to think about. And I think that there are three things that stand, and this is what I'd like to pose to you as a question for us to talk about, is I think there's three things that stand in our way. And this is, again, from where I'm standing, which is not a corporate view. I don't exist in a corporation, but I exist surrounded by lots of people with good ideas. One is very short-term investment strategies. I don't know how to resolve this particularly. I think that the venture capital world likes quick returns, and unfortunately with these big problems and these big opportunities, the returns are not quick. We're talking about 10 years, 15 years, if you're lucky. Which was always the case in product and product development, period. The acquisition and merger space in product design looks very, very different than in tech. There is absolutely zero public funding around this, and I think that large corporations often co-invest with government around this space. So whether Microsoft, is anybody at Microsoft interested in this space, I'd love your opinions about whether these things are possible, that we can fund ideas like this. People tend to drop them in a kind of socially good bucket of investment, but I think that's really, because this is just, these are just the realities of the world we're going to be living in. This is just social. This is people. This is the world. So whether we can convince government to really put their money into small ideas and small companies, it's a hard sell. It's a hard sell, and so that's why it's hard. And I think that people are generally very impatient. So I now sell the Goodnight Lamp. I had the idea 10 years ago. And it's taken me 10 years to get it to market. I'm self-funded. I did all of the things that I was supposed to be doing with respects to exhibiting at CES, Kickstarter campaign, et cetera, et cetera. But even as those things didn't really give me the results I was after, I didn't stop. And I think that the hockey stick diagrams that we see when we talk about investment really encourage entrepreneurs to think about that hockey stick as the 18 months you're supposed to do something, and after 18 months you're supposed to give up because that means that there's no traction. And I think that's also not the right expectation. It's the right expectation if you're doing software. And that works in the software world, but in the hardware world you really have to sell basically one Christmas at a time a particular product, and one sale at a time and one customer at a time. So I think that that's also not helped. People give up too quickly. And software success stories are helpful in the software world, but not in the hardware world. It doesn't translate at all. The idea of selling to Facebook or Google or whoever in a certain period of time is difficult. There are so many companies that are, exist out there that do hardware and software. They will never sell to Facebook or Google, and that's okay. They'll probably sell to Mattel or probably sell to IKEA one day, maybe, if that's what they're interested in. But it might take a long time, and Mattel will look at them for a long period of time before making those kinds of acquisitions. It might never make sense for a big player, a big product player. How am I doing on time? We're good. Okay, great. So I think we both mostly have ourselves to blame in terms of interest. We're very, very fickle in our desires around tech generally. We like shiny, shiny things, and we like them to be done very quickly. And I think that's also unhelpful in solving the things that we really need to be solving. And we kind of have to face the music and dance. Because really, when you find that the Pope and China agree on something, anything, then you know the world is changing and we have to change with it. Thank you very much.